Well, very good morning to all of you. My name is Jose Zuniga, president of IAPAC. Great to be up here this morning to introduce our memorial colloquium speakers. But before I do, some of you may be aware, hopefully all of you are aware, that on June 6th, or June 8th through the 10th, the United Nations will be convening in the city of New York to work on and introduce a political declaration that will guide much of the work that occurs in the battle to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030. It's hugely important that we be involved in these deliberations, many have already, to ensure that we maintain a focus on targets, 90-90-90, zero stigma and discrimination, but it's important that we advocate for the necessary funding to get the job done and for the political will from leaders to ensure that the fight does not stall. There are serious concerns that may happen that have been expressed throughout this conference. And so I wanted to advise you that IAPAC has been accredited as the only global association of providers to represent clinicians, lay providers, and we fully intend to advocate for 90-90-90 and zero stigma and discrimination, as well as the optimization of the HIV care and prevention continuum. If any of you wish to share thoughts on issues you think we should be bringing to the table at the UN, please feel free to reach out to us via email, phone, or any other means possible. With that said, I have a great honor of introducing this memorial colloquium, the Mario S. Cooper Memorial Colloquium on the Quest for Dignity, Equity, and Rights for HIV-Affected Communities. Mario Cooper was a former Democratic political operative who gained prominence in the 90s by pressing leaders in Washington and the African-American community to address the disproportionate effect of AIDS on minorities. Mario served as a rare nexus linking politicians, AIDS and gay rights advocates, and civil rights leaders. He was an advanced man for President Jimmy Carter, worked on Bill Clinton's first presidential campaign, and managed the day-to-day operations of the 1992 Democratic National Convention at Madison Square Garden, where a Clinton aide and friend, Bob Hattori, who was openly gay and HIV positive, addressed the delegates. By 1996, AIDS had overtaken homicide as the leading killer of African-American men ages 25 to 44, but many influential African-American figures and organizations largely avoided discussing the issue. Mario is quoted as saying in an interview in Time magazine, "Our community is being ravaged by AIDS, yet most black leaders continue to treat the disease as if it's a problem of those people. Instead of focusing on the fact that prevention works, black leaders prefer to deny reality." Mario would not let the issue rest. He began using his connections to spread the word and became the chairman of the AIDS Action Council, a prominent advocacy group in Washington, D.C. In 1996, as a board member of the Harvard AIDS Institute, he led a national campaign, Leading to Life, to increase awareness of HIV disease. The campaign began with a conference that drew more than 100 African-American leaders in politics, higher education, business, entertainment, the news media, medicine, and religion. Attendees included the scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr. and David Satcher, who was the director of the CDC and later the Surgeon General of the United States. So it seems fitting that we dedicate this memorial colloquium to him, who died on May 29th of 2016 in a hospice after having stopped eating because of depression. He had been HIV positive since the early 1990s and was 61 years old. So we dedicate this memorial colloquium to him as a former IAPAC trustee in honor of his legacy and also to remind us that the needs of people living with HIV/AIDS, and including those who are aging with HIV, extend well beyond clinical and p-values. So with that said, we've selected two incredible speakers who, in many respects, are advancing their own incredible legacies in advocacy to end AIDS public health threat by 2030. Phil Wilson's first foray into the activist role came in 1983 when he read the poem, "Where Will You Be When They Come?" at a candlelight vigil. He organized that vigil and after that began working as the director of policy and planning for the AIDS Project Los Angeles. During his time, he was also the AIDS coordinator for Los Angeles. From 1990 to 1995, he served as co-chair of the Los Angeles HIV Health Commission. In 1995, he became a member of the HRSA AIDS Advisory Committee. He founded the Black AIDS Institute in 1999, and in 2010, he was appointed to President Obama's Presidential HIV Advisory Council, becoming the co-chair of the Disparities Committee, subcommittee. Anne is a coach, has a background in both humanities and public health. She has used her experience in the areas of education, creative problem solving, service delivery, quality of care, advocacy, and policy change. She is currently working as Advocacy Partnership Director at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation Europe. She focuses on access to prevention, testing, linkage to care, HIV-TB treatment and care, and combining clinical, basic, and social science for best programming of services and policy changes. She serves on the board of the Global Network of People Living with AIDS and the Board of Medicine Patent Pool. She's a member of the European AIDS Treatment Group and has served as its chair between 2009 and 2011. She's also past co-chair of the HIV-AIDS Civil Society Forum at the European Commission. With that, I leave you with two outstanding speakers who I know will enlighten us and push us to do more to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jose, for that introduction. And I'd like to also thank IAPAC and the conference co-chairs for inviting me to participate in this Mario S. Cooper colloquium. Before I get started, there are two people in the room that I want to acknowledge for the remarkable work that they have done, and two of the most brilliant minds in the field. Now, first of all, Dr. Eugene McCray from the CDC is here, and we're so grateful for the role that you play, Dr. McCray, every day. And also, one of the brightest men fighting this battle, Jeff Crowley, former National Director of ONAP at the White House. So we're so glad to see you this morning as well. You know, let me begin by saying that I knew Mario Cooper. Mario Cooper was my friend, and I know Mario Cooper. So that's a test to see who in this room is involved in politics. Jeff knows what I'm talking about in that particular quote. You know, this year's topic is the quest for dignity, equity, and rights for HIV-infected communities. You know, I think about talks all the time, and I'm reminded that Lincoln's Gettysburg Address was only 2 minutes long. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech was only 17 minutes long. And if I'm no Mario Cooper, then I'm certainly no Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King Jr. But I don't need a lot of time to talk about the quest for dignity, equity, and rights for HIV-affected communities. Quite frankly, that's easy. Quite frankly, it's already been done. Didn't President Obama answer that question in the vision statement for the National HIV-AIDS Strategy when he said, "The United States will become a place where new HIV infections are rare, and when they do occur, every person, regardless of age, gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, or socioeconomic circumstance, will have unfettered access to high-quality, life-extending care free from stigma and discrimination." So asked and answered. So I guess I should really just sit down now. But as my mother would say, that would be too much like being right. So if it's not the vision statement, or at least not just the vision statement, then what is it? In 1964, Fannie Lou Hamer, the head of the Freedom Democrats from Mississippi, in her long quest for equality said, "I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired." The poet Essex Hempel wrote, "I want to start an organization to save my life. If whales, snails, dogs, cats, Chrysler, and Nixon can be saved, the lives of black men are priceless and can be saved. We should be able to save each other. I don't want to wait for a report from the Heritage Foundation to release a study saying that black people are extinct." One of, if not the leading conversation going on in AIDS activist circles these days is, can we end the AIDS epidemic? And can we end it by 2025, as some are calling for? Or should we even put a date on it? So let's start with what we know and what we have. We have new tools that we've never had before. Some would say we have the tools to end the AIDS epidemic. We have new surveillance tools. We can identify where the epidemic is down to the zip code or census tract. We have new diagnostic tools. It has never been easier or more important to know your HIV status. Today, getting your HIV status, HIV test can be free in most communities. It's easy, it's simple, it's painless, often it's done without blood. You can even get a result back in 60 minutes. If you're really anxious, you can get a 1-minute test. If you're concerned about privacy, you can take a test in the privacy of your own home. We can even do a test for acute HIV infection. So we have better diagnostic tools. We have new treatment tools, fewer pills, fewer side effects, more efficacious. We have the ability to start treatment, and we know we should start treatment as early in the disease process as possible because we know that HIV is an inflammatory disease. We know that it doesn't really go dormant. We know that, in fact, it begins to do damage as soon as it enters your body. So we have better treatment tools. I'm actually a living example of that. I've been living with HIV now for over 35 years. I personify what can happen when people with HIV have the love and support of family and friends and have the treatment and care that we need and deserve. I'm alive today because we have better treatment. We have better prevention tools. We have treatment as prevention that allows us to interrupt transmission to HIV by up to 90%. We have the ability to interrupt acquisition of HIV by also over 90% by pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. We have NPEP that can prevent infections even after exposure. So we have better diagnostic tools, better surveillance tools, better treatment tools, better prevention tools. We have wider access to treatments through the Affordable Care Act. Now, where you can't be denied care because you have a pre-existing condition, that we've eliminated annual caps or lifetime caps. We've expanded access to pharmaceutical care under the Affordable Care Act. There are problems still there, but we have expanded access to care. We have the power of new policy tools through the National HIV/AIDS Strategy that was reaffirmed this past year with clear guidelines. Now, there might in fact be a light at the end of the tunnel, and that light might just not be an oncoming train. But let's not get it twisted. Being able to end the AIDS epidemic is not necessarily the same as doing so. And biomedical interventions alone are not going to get us, as my friend Greg Gonzalez says, through the last mile. If biomedical interventions alone would get the job done, we wouldn't be dealing with tuberculosis. We wouldn't be dealing with syphilis. We've had a cure for syphilis for 75 years now, and yet we have raging syphilis going on in every part of this country. Every night, I take my ARVs, and as I get older, a few other things that have nothing to do with HIV, and I look at those pills every night. And there's something that I observe, that not a single one of those pills has the ability to get into my body without my assistance. They don't have feet, they don't have hands or arms or any kind of mobility whatsoever. So in order for them to work, they need me to do something. Now, what they do is biomedical. What I do is behavioral. And so as we move towards ending the AIDS epidemic, we need to find ways to inextricably connect the behavioral, the structural, and the biomedical to get us to the end game. So as this effort to raise the HIV/AIDS profile in this year's presidential contest, a number of us have been calling the presidential candidates to talk about HIV and AIDS and attempt to arrange meetings with them. Tomorrow, in fact, there's going to be a meeting with Secretary Clinton in New York. So here are some of the things we plan to talk with Secretary Clinton, and if we get a chance, the other presidential candidates as well. So to begin with, the message matters. If we're going to talk about ending the AIDS epidemic, what we call that effort matters. Branding matters. You know, so for example, an AIDS-free generation begs the question, what happens to me? What happens to folks who are living with HIV is all of a sudden we have an AIDS-free generation. So maybe that's not the right branding to deal with. Branding is important. We can take our clue from things like the war on drugs, which actually ended up being the war on poor and black communities, and that didn't work out so well for us, did it? We also need to make sure that the messenger as well matters. You know, that we have an epidemic that's disproportionately impacting people of color, disproportionately impacting transgender women, disproportionately impacting, you know, gay and bisexual men across the racial spectrum, but especially young black gay and bisexual men, and impacting young people as well, disproportionately impacting communities of the South. We need to make sure that those representations, those institutions that represent those populations that are most impacted are included front line in this in those efforts. Kind of a FUBU concept. Nothing about us without us has to be our mantra if we're going to be successful in ending the AIDS epidemic. Next, we need to commit to ending the AIDS epidemic with a specific timeline. Now, right now, there's a debate going on about that because some people are afraid of failure, afraid to set a deadline and to miss that deadline. I'm not in that camp. I think we have to set a deadline. As my grandmother used to say, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. We need to know what we're going to do and when we're going to do it by. We need to hold ourselves and each other and our governments accountable. So we need to commit to ending the AIDS epidemic, and I support a deadline by 2025 in the United States. So by dramatically reducing new infections, ending AIDS deaths, and eliminating disparities in access to quality HIV prevention and treatment. We also need to commit to ending the global AIDS pandemic, and we're looking at the date of 2030 by increasing the budget for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, by at least $2 billion per year by 2020, expanding our commitment in the Global Fund, and expanding our footprint in actually engaging in effective strategies around the globe. We need to maintain the U.S. leadership in HIV research. We have these great new biomedical tools, both for treatment and therapeutic purposes and for prevention. But we still need a vaccine, and ultimately, we will need a cure. And the only way we're going to get there is by scaling up or continuing to put pressure on our investments in research. We need to ensure that access to medicine exists for all of us. We must bring available treatments and prevention tools to scale to have the necessary impact in the epidemic, and we need to do that everywhere. We need to address the disproportionate impact that HIV has based on where you live. In the United States, now whether or not you live or die can be based on who's the governor of your state. Whether you live or die shouldn't be based on whether you live in the global South or the global North. So making sure these tools are available to everybody no matter where they are. And towards setting the goals, we need to make sure that we're setting interim goals towards our 2025 and our 2030 goals. For example, by 2020, we need to reduce new HIV infections to no more than 23,000 per year, down from the nearly 40,000 a year that we currently have. And the updated national HIV/AIDS strategy, where we look at the 90-90-80 framework, meaning 90% of persons living with HIV are diagnosed, 90% have access to quality HIV care, and 80% of persons in care achieve viral suppression, a dramatic improvement to where we are now. We also need to look at, by 2025, that we have no more than 12,000 HIV infections per year,
In that regard, we need to up the ante, looking at more like a 95-95-95 goals, where 95% of persons living with HIV in the U.S. will be diagnosed, that 95% of persons diagnosed will be retained in high-quality medical care, and 95% of persons in care will be virally suppressed. In part, we have to change some of the ways we're doing work and some of the places we're doing it. In some ways, we operate in the HIV world in kind of an Alice in Wonderland school of public health, where we pretend what is isn't and what isn't is. The truth of the matter is that today, anyone that actually wants now, to know their HIV status, by and large, we've gotten them already. The low-hanging fruit has been gotten. Now, and so we need to change from some of the places that we're doing the work to some of the places where the work needs to be done. I often tell the story about a guy who lost his keys. Some of you may have heard me tell this story. Well, he's looking for his keys, and another guy comes up to him and says, "What are you doing?" And the first guy says, "Well, I'm looking for my keys." And the second guy says, "Where was the last time you saw your keys?" And the first guy says, "About a mile down the road." And the second guy scratches his head and says, "So why are you looking here?" And he says, "Because the light is better." Sometimes that's how we do HIV prevention, where the light is better, where it's easier to do the work instead of where the work needs to be done. So we need to look at that as we move forward in finding an end game for HIV. We need to focus on reducing the HIV-related health disparities in the United States. The health disparities consist in the United States across the board. Black Americans represent 12% of the U.S. population, but account for almost half of new HIV infections, almost half of the folks living with HIV, and almost half of the annual HIV/AIDS deaths. MSMs account for 2/3 of new infections in 2014, and new infections among the youngest MSMs, 13 to 24, increased 22% between 2008 and 2010. The CDC just released a study saying that young black MSMs have a 1 in 2 chance of getting infected during the course of their lifetime. The overall infection rate for transgender women is 28%. And in the southern states, we account for over half of all new AIDS diagnoses and deaths of HIV-positive persons. So we have these disparities based on gender and sexual orientation and race and region of the country where you live. As my friend Kathy Iyer says, you know, no effort to end the AIDS epidemic can happen without going through the South. Also, it's important to note that the Southern epidemic is also a black epidemic. And so focusing on the epidemic addresses some of those issues. But looking at health disparities, again, are critical. It's important that all of the suggested goals pay attention not only to the absolute terms, so we need to reduce new infections by 23%, but we also need to 23,000, I'm sorry, but we also need to make sure that those numbers are specific to the different subgroups. It's not enough for just the overall numbers to go down. We also need to be real. That ending the AIDS epidemic in the U.S. and globally is something that is not going to be done just by going through a checklist, no matter how well-defined, clear, or justified that checklist might be. There is AIDS fatigue. AIDS is not as sexy as it once was. HIV/AIDS activists, no, we're not as powerful as we once were. And let's be honest, try as we might, black and brown and trans lives really don't matter as much as they need to in many quarters of our society. And so we talk about Black Lives Matter because Black Lives Matter is critical if we're going to be serious to ending the AIDS epidemic. All lives matter. Disenfranchised lives matter, and we're not going to get to the end game until and unless we understand that. The ending the AIDS epidemic is going to require us to bring all of what we have and more to do, and all of what we have and all that we can do up to scale. We need anyone and everyone who has expertise to solve this last mile problem we face working with us. That group will include folks from ASOs, activists, clinicians, scientists, the private sector involved in service delivery in other areas, community members who know their neighborhoods, and that will only happen if we do it everywhere all the time. In 1906, after fighting women's suffrage for 58 years, Susan B. Anthony said about the suffrage movement, "Failure is not an option." And so it is for those of us affected by HIV and AIDS. Our dignity, our equity, our rights are inextricably connected to a real and a successful effort to ending the AIDS epidemic. I have a reoccurring dream. And in my dream, there's a little boy. The little boy asked a wise old woman, "Where were you during the plague years? Where were you when millions and millions of people were dying?" And I always wake up before the wise woman has a chance to answer. I'm afraid I wake up because I'm afraid of the answer. I'm afraid the answer will be not enough. I believe that the day will come when this epidemic will be over. And when it does, it's important for them to know that we were not all monsters, that we were not all cowards, that some of us dared to care in the face of it. Some of us dared to love in spite of it. Some of us dared to fight because of it. Because it is in the caring and the loving and the fighting that we live forever. Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and I feel, I feel really gracious that I can be here, and I'm not for the first time at Adherence conference. Actually, it's my third time, and it's the third time with Phil, which is also very wonderful. And yesterday, we were talking in the morning about community sessions, and actually, I had this immense pleasure to take part in last year's community session and 2 years ago. And now I'm standing here to talk a little bit, my community perspective, but also activist perspective, but also worker perspective and program manager perspective. I would like to share a little bit of this experience of my work or the work that we do, AHF Europe, AIDS Healthcare Foundation Europe. We work in European Union and Eastern Europe, in Russia and in Ukraine, in Estonia, in Lithuania, in Greece, Portugal, the Netherlands. But before that, I would like to share with you, because I don't want to be also too formal, right, after this beautiful speech. I've been studying since the age of 16, actually. I've been studying spiritual scriptures, and I've been studying and following yoga. And this year, I also, this year was also very interesting for me because I wanted to get back to it a little bit more. And this year, I was also studying spiritual scriptures, Bhakti Yoga, Bhagavad Gita, and other books. And then I was asking myself a question, why I'm still alive? And I've been living with HIV for more than 20 years, 23 years right now. I used to inject drugs, and actually most of my friends who used to inject drugs with me are gone, right? And I'm still alive, and I'm still here, and I'm still kicking, and I'm still doing things, and every day is a wonderful journey, right? So, why am I still alive, and what really helped me? And actually, I got to it like very, very, very recently. I think I got, and I wanted to share it with you, Because I think it's also very important, like when we think about like drug use and also the world and what is needed for people who are sometimes not respected and not supported, what people need. So I think the first lesson, because I started injecting drugs when I was 17, and actually first lesson came with the first injection. So I went to Warsaw, our capital, being ready for the first injection with friends. So like, and then we got drugs, right? We found out our way. And then after the first injection, it came out that, you know, the stuff was really crap, right? They sold us something, right? We were young girls, right? They sold us something really low quality, right? So the first person was, don't really trust people so much, right? Drug scene will not take care of you. People would like to use you, would like to use your money, and would like to steal from you. And the second message actually came with the second shot. It was in the town where I was born, in Bydgoszcz, and this was a completely different situation. So we were with friends, a little bit more safe situation. I injected for the second time, but before, well, I didn't know, I didn't prepare for it. But before that, I took some pills. You know, so then I mixed a few things, and drugs were really, really good. And then on the second, during the second injection, I had a situation of overdose. And thanks God, I was with a friend who resuscitating me and helped me to go through it. And then the message, as I read it right now, is like, be careful what you are taking. And because you don't know, these are street drugs. And also, try to be with people who can support you. But then, also, that the third question for me was, what really gave me the strength to go through this? Because I had like history of 6 years of using drugs, and then a few other things happened. And how did I actually manage to get out of this, right? And then I think, I found actually an answer probably a month ago only when meditating. So, I was reading Bhagavad Gita when I was 16. So I was doing bhakti yoga and really, you know, like trying to get this love, trying to get this feeling, this support, right? And I had this this message coming from Bhagavad Gita that, you know, doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you do, right? It doesn't really matter if you follow me, meaning God, Ishvara, nature, Bhagavan, whoever, however we call it, however we call the God or the nature, the energy. I will be with you, and even if you don't follow me, and if you die, right, at the last moment when you think of me, you can still get to me, right? So I was thinking, right now when I'm thinking of it, it's like it was such a powerful message because it doesn't really matter who you are, right? We are all human beings, right? We all have the spark of love in ourselves, right? And then we can always get to it, right? And if we can feel that there is love, that there is some support, it really strengthens us. And we don't really need to think of it. So I'm really gracious for this lesson. I think this, it helps me to fight. Because I think, well, right now I'm working, I'm a community activist, but actually I decided on my way, on my journey, that I would also learn more about program management and healthcare and public health, and use two sides of the coin. So sort of my skills, because I also learn quite quickly, and probably this also helped me to survive. But I would like also to share. So I think, unfortunately, we still have a lot of things to do. And I wanted to share with you actually a few slides that are coming from the last few days and a few news which are pretty disturbing. And then I would like also to share with you a few things that we do. So this is actually the continuum of care in Europe and Central Asia. And I'm really happy that I can also talk about Eastern Europe because Ambassador Birks was also talking about Russia. We had one presentation about Russia here and Ukraine, but I think it's not enough. So here is the cascade of care in Europe. And as you can see, the problems, the coverage in terms of treatment coverage, but also in terms of viral suppression, the biggest problem is Eastern Europe. And here you, Russia and Ukraine are not included in this graph, but there are also continua of care for Russia and for Ukraine. So for Ukraine right now, as they look at it, 20% of people who live with HIV are virally suppressed, and in Russia it's between 10-11%. So really we are talking about huge gaps, right? And not only, of course, in viral suppression. The other thing is, this is the recent UN Secretary General report coming April 2016, and these are regional targets for, these are regional targets for new HIV infections. Of course, we need to, as Phil was talking, we need to set bold targets, but right now, I'm going to concentrate on Eastern Europe and Central Asia. In 2010, there were 120,000 new infections. Actually, in 2014, in Russia alone, there were 110,000 new infections. And here, right now, the target is 44,000 for the whole region. And here, we are talking about a situation where condoms are really not accepted because, in Russia, we see, especially in Orthodox communities, it is not really accepted. You can't promote use of condoms, and really, even in the national plans, it's difficult to put wording condom there. And of course, we don't have harm reduction services there. So I'm not really sure here about the goals, if they are really achievable, if there is not really good work done. And here, regional targets for treatment coverage. And I will also look at Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And you see they are really bold. But for Eastern Europe, we are talking about five-time increase of treatment coverage. I think it's a fantastic goal, but unfortunately, I'm not sure it is feasible. And why? Also in the report, there is a call for dramatic pullout of international funding from upper middle-income countries. And countries in the region of Eastern Europe, they are upper middle-income countries or high-income countries. And, the report acknowledges that domestic investments nearly tripled in 8 years between 2006 and 2014, but the hope is, or rather wishful thinking, that in the next 5 years, low-income countries will increase domestic funding by 450%, and lower-middle-income countries will increase domestic funding by 530%. I will repeat once again. I think it's a wishful thinking, and I think we need to be really steady about the funding that we have. And of course, the question is, how much money we have, if we have money for Global Fund, if we have replenishment, if we have replenishment at the level that we have previously, right? Because right now, the plans for the next replenishment is 13 billion, which is lower than the previous replenishment. So what we need to do, we need to fight for funding. We still need to fight for funding for HIV. And then the report that came actually yesterday from Edwin Bernard, it's a report on prosecutions. Today we are going to talk about it as well. But if you look about prosecutions for HIV non-disclosure, potential or perceived exposure, so Russia is, we are talking about at least 115 cases. United States is also a lead, at least 104. We have cases in Belarus, Canada, and in UK. And this is also news from yesterday. Gilead gets patent for hepatitis C drugs, Sovaldi, in India. And this was the second court case, because the first decision of the court was against the patent, but the second decision is for. So the feeling is that the decision is a major blow to access to drug movement. Of course, we are talking about hepatitis C drugs, but this situation might affect generic markets, and actually if countries who can access generic drugs can access them. So there is a lot to do. We need to fight. And I wanted to share with you a quote from Gus Speth, who is an environmentalist, a researcher. He works tirelessly on making the planet thrive. And he says, I used to think that the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that with 30 years of good science, we could address those problems. But I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with those, we need spiritual and cultural transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do it. And I think the word spiritual and cultural transformation are really important here, because we have all the tools, right? But right now, what we need to have a will, a wish to use it, and also commitment, and also compassion to the people who need help. So I wanted to share with you our work in Europe, and this is the work in Estonia, and Narva is a border town between Estonia and Russia. So it's at the border of European Union and Russia, and right now you probably know that also NATO sent troops to Estonia, but there were some military exercises a week ago in Estonia. So there were 6,000 troops, and NATO was sending 1,500 people. This is a town with 60,000 people who live there, and the town has the biggest prevalence rate in the whole European Union, which is 4%. Or right now, actually, the estimations are a little bit more than 4%. So this is the continuum of care for Estonia, but also continuum of care in Narva. So you can see that, in the small town, it's a Russian-speaking town with a lot of problems, unemployment problems, but also HIV is a huge problem there. So what we did, AHF Europe, but also Estonian network of people who live with HIV, actually we build up a clinic. We build up a clinic which is called Linda Clinic, which comes from the needs of the community of people who live with HIV, because the dire reality is also that there is only one hospital in the town and only one infectious disease doctor to serve, as you saw, this 2,000 people who know their status, but of course there are many more who don't know. So we built up the clinic together. It was a huge fight. Some of you know the fight, and many of you supported us because, in Estonia, there are only five regional hospitals that can provide treatment, but there was no room for a private or community-run clinic. And we engaged in a three-year-long battle to, first of all, set up the clinic, to get the license, and finally, after actually two court cases, to receive ARVs to the clinic that the patients are able to receive treatment and care there. So right now we have 211 patients, one third of them use drugs. In terms of treatment, right now we have 74% coverage, and then in terms of viral suppression, you see it's below 60%. We also get support from how we build the clinic, because the clinic is works. We have of course medical team, but we have also the whole team that surrounds. Surrounds the patient, so we have peer workers who are people who live with HIV. We have testers. We have social worker who provides help with debt relief, with finding housing, with finding work, because homelessness is also quite a big problem. And we actually had a visit during the military exercises. We had a visit of U.S. ambassador to Estonia, and actually the embassy really supported us there as well. And you can see here in one of the pictures, we have the ARVs available for the patients. But in terms of the challenges, there are still a few challenges, and I would like probably to focus on one, which is, well, of course, national strategy is lacking, rapid testing is a problem, but I wanted to share with you the patient information consent form. So it's also very interesting because, when you run a clinic, you also see all these things that you really realize what is happening. So I will read the patient information and consent form. So it's a part, it's the second part of the document. I understand that I require ARV. So this is a consent form that every patient in Estonia needs to sign before initiation of treatment. I understand that I require ARV treatment. I assure that I have been informed in a way that it's comprehensible to me of my health status, treatment possibilities, the nature and expediency of the treatment prescribed to me, and the side effects and possible consequences of the treatment. Assure that I will take the drugs agreed upon in the treatment regime consistently and diligently. Agree to personally come get the drugs from the treatment facility once a month. In exceptional cases, prolonged absence from Estonia, mobility difficulties, and with a written agreement describing the exceptional case, I may agree upon an alternative way of receiving the drugs. I'm aware that the drugs are free of charge to me as long as I follow the treatment regime as required. Keeping to treatment regime is evaluated by the doctor and, if necessary, by the treatment council, who is entitled to stop providing drugs if the training regime is repeatedly violated against. In that case, continuing the treatment is possible only by purchasing the drugs again against payment for a pharmacy by prescription. And this is 2016, right? European Union. So this is the thing that actually this is the next thing that we need to fight, because this is a clear violation of human rights to free access to treatment. And a few other issues, but not from Estonia. And also probably a few asks, because I think as we are all working together here, so probably you have ideas how to take care of the issues. I think what for the region, what we need to do, because we don't, as in US, we don't have the approach that we don't have test and treat or test and start approach that is this in US. We really need to work hard on implementation of WHO treatment and testing guidelines, and also the guidelines that came from IPEC on continuum of care. I think they are important guidelines. And if I could have a request to IPEC, I think they could be more publicized. And because, well, they are not actually, the guidelines are not really known and utilized in the region. And I think they will be really important help how to help with continuum of care. Then the next thing, the next problem that we have is health workforce and task shifting. So for Estonia, for example, and maybe you also have some ideas here, well, we have only one doctor, because all other doctors flee to Finland. It's not sexy to live in Narva, you can imagine, right? So either you go to city, to the capital, either you go to Finland, because the salaries are much higher. So no one wants to work in Narva, and no one wants to work with people who live with HIV, who have problems with homelessness, with drug use, and low adherence, and many, many issues. So the question is actually, how can we bring, for me, the question is right now, how can I bring one or two doctors? Because right now, I only rely on a doctor, one doctor that I have who is available only one day per week. And maybe there are some programs, maybe like university programs or something like that. I don't know. Maybe you have some ideas for collaboration with Linda Clinic. And then the other question is nurses, because in Eastern Europe, we don't have the system that you have here in US, and actually probably 50% of the health personnel is not utilized enough. Because nurses are not involved in in adherence and care as much as they should, and I do hope also on collaboration also with IPEC on this issue, that we can strengthen the skills of the nurses, but also the feeling about self-worth and strength of this part of health workforce. HIV TB, TB was not very much discussed during the meeting here, but it's a huge issue for us in Eastern Europe, especially with MDR TB in Russia and in Ukraine, and the deaths or the number of deaths is really high. So This is another thing, how we integrate and also how we collocate the services, because so we need to build the whole infrastructure a little bit differently. And what we did also in Ukraine, AHF, we brought, but it's only an example of one hospital in Boyarka, close to Kiev. We brought an infectious disease doctor. First of all, we brought testing to TB hospital, because TB testing was not available for every every TB patient. And then we brought the infectious disease doctor, and then we brought treatment there. And it works. We all know that it works, but this kind of models, we need to work much more on this, that it's working together. We need to work on decentralization in Eastern Europe, still there's big cities at the center. They have big centers. They are overcrowded. There's not much space for talking about issues about how you feel, what about your life, and how are you doing with medications. It's very mechanical sort of approach. Data management is another thing for quality, of course, and understanding what is happening in the program. So what we brought also, we brought the data management system, and actually in a few programs, there were huge surprises in understanding that, for example, instead of 5,000 patients, they have 3,000 patients, some of them diseased, some of them moved somewhere. Another huge issue is healthcare in prisons. And of course, you have a little bit different system here, but the disconnect between prisons and healthcare setting is so huge that, for example, in Russia, when we look at, for example, Krasnoyarsky Krai, which is the Siberia region, which is the region with the highest number of prisons because of climate, right? So you make it tough. There is a big proportion of people who live with HIV who are in prisons, receive treatment in prisons, but then after leaving prisons, there is no actually connection, no information flow between the prison and healthcare facility, and even the healthcare facility. Like, they struggle, and receiving the information happens only after 2-3 months. So there is confusion. People are on different drugs. We are trying to work on this as well. And actually, we will be starting. And I really hope for it that it will happen. But we want to start. We got a request from one prison in. And Krasnoyarsky Krai to start working with us. So I do hope, and it's, as you can imagine, it's a really close facility. So I do hope that we can bring some change there, but also help medical professionals there, because the information there in prisons, how to treat, how to take care, how to test also, is really minimal. Or for example, understanding rapid testing technology is also very minimal. The other issue is chemsex. And have you heard about chemsex? Who heard about chemsex? Okay. Yes. Chemsex or slamming, right? Or chilling out, right? And we work also in Western Europe, so using the substances, right, like methadone, methamphetamine, GHB, and with really for partying and for sex. And we see a huge problem and with this issue in Western Europe, London, Amsterdam, Berlin. So we are going to look into this, the connection, but also we will need to bring, and we also, this issue was also not discussed here, but we will need also to bring some harm reduction services there. And of course, the last thing is progressive management. And it's quite a big thing, but probably, progressive thinking, but not also allowing corruption, which is a huge thing in the region. I'm going to skip this because we talked actually about user-driven care. So We started working on user-driven care, and you are also doing it. It's Community Advisory Board. So we are starting doing it in Europe, and I hope that we can work with people who work already on this, and AIDS Institute is working on this, and you have, and I would like to sort of promote it a little bit, because you have in US this fantastic healthcare stories project, which looks at patients' experience in healthcare, and it's HealthQual who is doing this, and Bruce Uggins. But it looks at perspectives of a patient in healthcare. So what kind of service, what a patient understands, or what healthcare means, or quality, what healthcare means for the person. So here is an example of a word cloud. But these are examples also from other from the rollout of the project. So you see the words respectful, friendly, caring, good. And this is the second part, which I think is also very interesting, to look at how the visit went. So look at each step of the visit and sort of reflect how it went out for the patient, what was good, but what needs to be, what could be also improved. And here you have an example of the word cloud, but also the second part of the project. And they are also working on co-production of health. So looking at the linkages between patients and providers. So co-planning, co-delivery, and co-assessment. So to end up, I think the most important thing is respect, but I was also talking about my story and what really helped me. So I think respect is a fantastic word, but I think we need to talk a little bit more about these words. Thank you.